This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, you know, all this week we've been talking a lot about the semiconductor area, really for the last few weeks, some concerns about the outlook. And this story certainly plays into it. We got this last night, a Bloomberg exclusive. Intel shares certainly, I think they were a little bit higher, actually. And this is on the news that the chip giant is planning thousands of job cuts to cut costs and cope with a PC slump.
We're talking some serious job cuts, too. This exclusive by our own Mark Gurman and Debbie Wu. We got Mark Gurman on the line right now. He's technology reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us from our Los Angeles bureau. And if you're watching on YouTube, you'll be able to see him there as well. So, Mark, give us the details here, because as I mentioned, we're talking serious job cuts potentially affecting about 20% of staff. What's going on?
Yeah, so if you are an Intel employee, this is bad news. If you are an Intel shareholder slash investor, this is potentially good news. As Carol mentioned, the stock is up a little bit today, so there has been some benefit from this news there. These are going to be major cuts. I'm told that this is likely to be the largest layoff to hit Intel since 2016. At that point, they laid off, under former CEO Brian Krzanich, about 11% of the company, or 12,000 employees across the entire corporation globally. This is probably not going to be as big as that, but it is going to be something that requires some sort of major restructuring. I'm told the employee count is going to be in the thousands. Let's just face it, the PC market over the last couple quarters has slowed dramatically. Some of the PC maker shipment totals have, dropped 30 to 40%. You look at Lenovo, you look at HP, you look at some of the other PC makers that use Intel processors, you're seeing a drop off there. So clearly, Intel's bread and butter, that's slowing down. At the same time, their profits are also shrinking. Right, so it's not a good situation for Intel right now. They're reporting earnings on October 27th. That's their third quarter earnings. We are anticipating about a 20% year-over-year decline. Profit is down 15 basis points right from their usual measure. So they have to do these layoffs to really try to up their profit, up their gross margins, and that's why you're seeing the positive reaction from the stock. But obviously, we're talking about human beings here. We're talking about employees. This is not going to be a positive sight. This is going to be one of the bigger layoffs in the chip sector. Two companies that compete with Intel, Micron and NVIDIA, recently said they wouldn't be doing layoffs. But ARM, right, a key technology competitor to Intel, and Oracle, who competes with Intel on the server side, the data center side, they have seen some cuts recently.
Mark, awkward, as you point out in your story, this is an awkward moment for Intel because they lobbied so much for that $52 billion chip stimulus bill this year, and they talked about expanding chip manufacturing, semi-manufacturing here in the United States in particular, so not a good look.
Not a good look, but a lot of the damage is already done, right? They need, because they clearly have to cut their costs, they need to do something. And unfortunately, it looks a lot like that's going to come on the human side, right, with those thousands of cuts to employees. We're actually told that a lot of the cuts are going to come in their sales and marketing group, right? And that's typically where you see cuts happen, initially in these types of circumstances, right? Marketing and sales. That's one group. It's called SMG at Intel. It's one mixed part of the organization. We're told cuts there could come as high as 20% of that division, right? But in terms of the general cut company-wide, that number will be less than 20% overall. But, sales and marketing, you're going to see a big hit there, unfortunately.
Hey, Mark, we got about a minute and a half left with you, and I wanted to touch on among your latest stories, this one about Apple. Carol and I talked about this a little earlier. The company's planning to withhold its latest employee perks from its unionized store. What can you tell us about what's happening there, and put it in the context of the types of benefits that Apple does provide its employees?
So for 2023, three new benefits. One, tuition reimbursement is now going to be tuition prepay for some colleges. So Apple will pay in advance so they don't have to reimburse you at the end of the semester. Coursera, normally $400 a year for a subscriber online. That's going to be a free subscription now for Apple employees. And then the healthcare plan through United Health, that's going to get some improvements, waived copays for select doctors in regions like New York, New Jersey, Washington State, Connecticut, and a couple other states. Those perks not coming to Maryland, right, in terms of the Towson store in Maryland. That's Apple's sole unionized store. So they're going to have to negotiate if they want to get those into their collective bargaining agreement. This is interesting timing. What's happening tomorrow? Well, voting will now begin for a second potentially unionized store, this one in Oklahoma City. We'll see if this news has any impact there shortly.
It's like another volley, the back and forth with this issue. Mark Gurman, great reporting. As we mentioned, that Intel story, a Bloomberg exclusive by Mark. Mark is technology reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from our LA bureau. And just to remind everybody, as Mark pointed out too, that Intel shares up about 1.6%. As he said, not good news for several, a bunch, in fact, Intel workers, but investors certainly liking the news that they're cutting
costs. Yeah, so much to this story. What's happening in the PC market around the world, and then, of course, also the CHIPS Act here in the U.S.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The story that keeps on giving, and it isn't quite over yet. We're talking about Elon Musk's pursuit of Twitter. And this week in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, the cover story is about Twitter and how it faces only bad outcomes if Elon's $44 billion deal closes.
That piece by Kurt Wagner, he's technology reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from San Francisco this afternoon. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. You can follow Joel on Twitter at Joel Weber Show and Kurt Wagner at Kurt Wagner 8. Hey, Kurt, I want to send it over to you to start with this afternoon. So you can't win. It's like you win. It's like there's no good outcome here is my big takeaway from your story, because the company has been so beat up over the drama. And if it goes through, then what does that look like?
Yeah. And that's, you know, what we've been talking about for a couple months now is that, you know, what is the end result here? And I think it became abundantly clear that no matter what happens, you know, Twitter, the company, is in for a crazy ride. And, you know, if Elon gets Twitter, as we are starting to expect, you know, that's going to lead to layoffs, cost cuts, going to rescind a lot of the rules around speech and misinformation is the expectation. So, you know, suddenly this service that's incredibly important is going to look and feel very different. And the company is going to look and feel different. Now, if for some reason this deal falls apart, suddenly you still have a company that, you know, has spent the last 6 to 9 months just in total chaos, and they have to kind of pick up and try and pretend like nothing ever happened. And I just don't think that that's realistic either. So, you know, the story was meant to kind of give people a glimpse into what the Twitter employees are feeling right now, which is a lot of chaos.
Tough place to be in. Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, also with us. First of all, can I just say the cover? And you made Elon nice pecs there.
Yeah, he's got some good biceps too. So Kurt, we've been talking about this for months. You know, it's obviously probably one of the biggest business stories of the year. And I'm curious. You know, one of the things that that you had in here was even some new stuff about, you know, what the employees really felt about their potential new boss. So take us there and sort of these slacks that you were able to get.
Well, there's two scenes that are in the book. The first one is from early 2020. Elon showed up at a Twitter offsite with the entire company, and he complained about bots. And you know, at that point, everyone kind of just sort of shrugged it off, like, here's just a popular user who has an issue. Fast forward 2.5 years, and suddenly Elon is still complaining about bots, but now, you know, when he addresses employees in an all hands in June, the vibe is very different, right? It's no longer, here's this outside kind of tech celebrity showing up to give us advice. It's, here's the new boss starting to, you know, lay down the future of the company. And employees were not happy. You know, he alluded to layoffs. He alluded to other cost cuts, maybe getting rid of remote work, which a lot of people at Twitter have really come to enjoy. And so on Slack, they're basically mocking their soon-to-be boss as he's speaking to them. You know, there's things like, hey, is it too early to get a drink? Like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And, you know, that just gives you a sense of, like, how unhappy a lot of Twitter employees are with this, right? That they would openly mock kind of the new boss during the opening Q&A with staff. And I just think that it's only going to get worse from here, because there's a lot that's happened in the last couple months to make him even less attractive to a lot of Twitter employees.
Okay, so what you cut, he ends up, let's say he has to cut this check, $44 billion, right?
Right.
Like, don't bounce that check. That would be unfortunate. He becomes, you know, owner of Twitter after all of this. What chess moves go down from there, do we think?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. First and foremost, I imagine he's going to put in his own executive team. He's been pretty open that he has, you know, no faith in the current leadership at Twitter. We expect that CEO Parag Agrawal will probably be out. Also, the top lawyer, Vijay Gadde, will probably be out. So, you know, there's going to be new people at the top of this company. And then I think the other thing is, you know, he's talked a lot about wanting to bring, quote, free speech back to Twitter, right? And what does that mean? Well, for starters, it means reversing permanent bans. So we might see President Trump back on Twitter quite soon. We might see other people who have been banned back on Twitter. But I also think he's, you know, it sounds like he plans to get rid of a lot of the rules around harassment and hate speech and misinformation that Twitter has been building over the last couple of years. That's going to have a huge impact on just the vibe of what it feels like to scroll through your Twitter timeline, right? And I don't know exactly how quickly all that stuff can be unraveled, but I imagine, you know, Twitter might feel very different to people in the next couple months.
That's a really interesting point, Kurt, and that's one I really wanted to hit on, because there is there's got to be a portion of people who think that this is a good thing. I've seen it play out on Twitter, and you see a lot of of people say, wait a second, this is a good thing for Twitter because, you know, this is going to be more about quote-unquote free speech. So what else does it look like on the other side of this if this does go through? Does it actually attract more people? Does it become a more attractive platform? Or do those protections that Musk potentially takes away or could take away, does that hinder people's experience on it?
Well, you know, what's funny is there was a time probably 3 or 4 years ago when Twitter was still very much struggling with all of this hate speech and harassment stuff. And there were people leaving, right? Like, hey, I don't want to be on this hell site. I don't want to, you know, there were a lot of mean things said about Twitter, and people were saying that they were leaving, right? And then Donald Trump got this banned, and people said, well, now everyone's going to leave Twitter because they banned President Trump. And in both cases, the numbers didn't really reflect either of those things, right? Like, it was mostly people complaining about this, but the majority of users stuck around. Now, in this case, I think that's probably the same thing that's going to happen, right? There will be people who are happy to see some of these rules rescinded. Some people will be very sad, but for the most part, I imagine most people will probably stick around, at least in the near term.
Hey, Kurt, one thing I'm curious about too, though, is, you know, Elon Musk has a lot on his plate. Will he ultimately, have a deputy really, you know, running things at Twitter? How do we anticipate it might play out?
Yeah, this is still an unknown. You know, I mentioned that I think the current executive team is probably going to be out the door, but who does he bring in to run the day-to-day? It doesn't seem really feasible for him to do that considering his responsibilities at SpaceX and Tesla as well. But one thing he did tell employees in June and that we mentioned in the story is he said he doesn't really care much about titles, like is he the CEO, is he something else? But he wants to make the decisions. He wants people to listen to him, you know. So I do think he's going to be pretty involved, at least in the direction of where this company is going. Now, is he the one who's going to be, you know, answering emails all day about product tweaks? I don't know. It seems unlikely. But he does claim he wants to be heavily involved here.
I love the last line of your story about, I guess, what title or role Musk will be. And he says, I don't really care what the title is, but obviously people do need to listen to me.
That's right. Yeah. Who's in charge? The new guy.
All right. Great story. It is the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which will be out on newsstands tomorrow, online already at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg terminal. What?
What's the over-under on whether or not that title has the letter X in it? Something that he's just totally obsessed with.
You know.
COX?
It's a whole new dimension for where Elon could go here. And, like, you know, you thought Mars was the last one. So.
Oh, my gosh. And it ain't over yet.
Twitter, the final frontier.
All right. Our thanks to Kurt Wagner, Bloomberg News technology reporter, and, of course, Jill Weber of Business Week.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We just talked about airline stocks, really some outperformance today. The rally in American Airlines alone, up again and up around 5% in the past two trading days. The U.S. carrier yesterday lifting its forecast and its guidance above prior guidance. American officially reports next week, so does United. Meantime, we've got Delta reporting tomorrow.
All right, for a roundup of what to expect from airlines and already what we've heard, we turn to Colin Scarola, equity analyst at CFRA Research. Colin joins us this afternoon on the phone from New York City. So, Colin, as Carol mentioned, we've already heard from a pre-announcement from American Airlines. What does that tell us, what we learned from American yesterday? What does that tell us about what to expect across the wider industry?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. Specifically as it relates to Delta's earnings release tomorrow, I think what the American numbers tell us is that pricing across the industry, ticket pricing, is held up really strong. We haven't seen that.
I mean, sort of anyone who's tried to book a flight anywhere realizes that, right? I mean, it's like we're trying to decide if we drive for Thanksgiving or fly because it's so expensive, Colin.
Right, and I think what a lot of sort of industry watchers were expecting was that that big spring wave of booking would drive up the prices, but then they would start trailing down a bit over the summer. But it's been, you know, from American standpoint, and I expect it to be the same for Delta tomorrow, it's been great for them to see that the pricing really isn't coming down. Because maybe they're seeing a little bit of trailing down in domestic, but as they bring those international flights back, you see the brand new, that first big booking wave hitting the international markets. And that's keeping, I think, overall pricing very strong.
I feel like everybody, Colin, right now is going overseas. I mean, I hear everybody talking about, we talked about Katie Greifeld. She's overseas right now. Everybody seems to be
She's probably listening right now because she just can't take a break. She's
tweeting about it.
She's tweeting a lot too.
But Colin, what I'm wondering is, so what are the big macro dynamics? Is this just a case of people who were stuck in their homes during the pandemic buying stuff they probably didn't need and now they're going out just kind of enjoying life and being back to normal and experiencing things? Is it that? But is it also reduced capacity, reduce workers, and so it's just kind of supply-demand dynamics at work in the airline industry?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. So you get unusually high demand with unusually low supply, and that's where this sort of 25-30% increase in pricing comes from relative to 2019. And just a few anecdotes, I think we have a record number of weddings happening in the U.S. this year and next year. You know, that's the type of thing that's driving that leisure travel demand, plus the vacation demand, getting to Europe, wherever it might be that people used to love to go. And then what's good to see for the industry is we saw the consumer and the households have that huge pent-up demand streak this mm-hmm. spring and summer. And I think now we're starting to see it from businesses as well. You look at a lot of the accounting and consulting firms who used to have people out on the road working at client sites 4 days every week, you know, that sort of Monday morning, Thursday night travel routine. That seems to be coming back in a pretty big way now this fall and into this winter. So what started with the pent-up demand on the consumer and leisure side, that, you know, it's still strong. It hasn't run its course. It's still very strong, but it's certainly not growth anymore, I don't think.
Right.
But now international and business are starting to see that same sort of big pent-up demand wave. So overall, very good things for the airlines, and they look like extremely cheap stocks to me generally.
That's interesting.
With how strong demand is.
Colin, do we ever see business travel resume to 2019 levels? And I ask because a friend of mine is an event planner for company. She plans conferences. And she was saying it is so much more economical to do these virtual conferences. The lead generation that we get per cost is just so much better. It's so much lower. And she's like, I don't see us ever going back to, you know, what we were doing before the pandemic because it was just too expensive.
Yeah, it's tough to make a call on that. I hear pieces of information like you just relayed, but then I also hear from a lot of surveys on businesses that you just can't replace face-to-face interaction. And I think my view tends to lean towards that it will come back bigger than it was. American Airlines specifically, they reported on small and medium business revenues, they're actually up 10% versus 2019 in the past Q2. So already small and medium businesses seem to be putting in greater demand for air travel than they were before the pandemic. And it's not a given that corporates, you know, the larger corporates will follow that same track.
Right.
But I certainly think that's the most likely outcome, just because I think people want to get back to seeing their clients and seeing their coworkers.
Hey, Colin, not to be a Debbie Downer, and just got about 30 seconds, I just want to squeeze in. If we go, though, to a downturn, or maybe we're already in it, but if something protracted happens, certainly into next year, are the airlines in good shape to weather it? And again, just got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think a recession would not hit the airlines as acutely as it has historically because of the pent-up demand factor. So a recession, in my view, it's hitting goods producing industries, whereas services like air travel will hold up pretty well because there's that natural offset from the pent-up demand.
All right. Well, good to know. Hey, Colin, thank you so much. Colin Scarola, equity analyst over at CFRA Research, on the phone in New York City. Don't forget, American United next week and Delta reporting tomorrow, I believe, more in the morning. And yeah.
I got to get those tickets for Thanksgiving. It's cutting it close.
Hurry up, or you're going to be driving.
Too expensive.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of PepsiCo, they are rallying today, and that is on the back of what we got from the company lifting its outlook, drink, snack sales, bucking inflation, meaning the company's still able to hike prices to battle inflation. So it was a strong quarter.
It was. And to help us understand what specifically was strong about it and how we can read into Pepsi's results for other companies, we've got Gerald Pascarelli joining us, Senior Vice President of Equity Research at Wedbush Securities. Gerald joining us on the phone from New York City. Good to have you with us this afternoon, Gerald. Really appreciate you taking the time. What did we find out from Pepsi about the strength of the consumer? Because they were able to raise prices and people paid.
First of all, thanks very much for having me. Excited to be on the show. And it was a great earnings from Pepsi. I think that when you look at the leading trends heading into earnings, which are typically going to come from scanner data, Nielsen or IRI, what you saw was just a continued strengthening of growth across really cold beverages as well as snacks. With Frito-Lay and for Pepsi, that accounts for over 40% of their total company profits. And the salty snacks data has just been fantastic. They're back to gaining market share, and they're actually in scanner data doing over 20 points of price. And so we thought it was going to be a good print. They delivered a good print. And what you really saw was price-led revenue growth across most of these segments, which is really not only driving a strong top line, but it's helping to protect against these outsized levels of commodity inflation. Mm-hmm. And it was really strong across the board when you look at all of their segments.
I just want to make sure I heard right. Frito-Lay and PepsiCo, you said, are 40% of the profits. So you're talking about PepsiCo, that brand, and then its Frito-Lay brand?
So Frito-Lay is a segment within that Pepsi reports on, and that segment in particular, Frito-Lay North America, is 40% of total company profit. So it's meaningful. It's the biggest profit driver. And when you're getting 20 points of price mix, and they actually reported 20 points of price mix, which is kind of in line with what we've been seeing in scanner, you're going to have good profitability.
Okay, so so far, so good in terms of having the ability to raise prices. As you know, the macro conversation, we often talk about, you know, the Fed continuing to raise rates, the prospect of recession, what kind of recession it would be. How much more can PepsiCo do something like this?
Yeah, I think that as of right now, pricing remains robust, and the volume the demand elasticity, so the volume impact has been relatively muted, which is encouraging. I don't think anyone's expecting this strong double-digit pricing to persist. And if you kind of look at where consensus estimates were for 2023 heading into the quarter, they're expecting a normalization to the mid-single-digit range. And so I think as you get more through the fourth quarter and then into 2023, you'll likely see a normalization in this pricing, which in turn should result in some better volume throughput as part of the revenue algorithm. But as of right now, you know, these are essentially lower price needs based products,
right?
Which is one of the benefits in the current environment is that consumers need these products, and they're relatively low price, so you can generate pretty meaningful price mix.
Hey, Jared, what about when it comes to Coca-Cola and what this means for Coca-Cola? Because there's no Frito-Lay equivalent at Coca-Cola.
There's not. But encouragingly, I did mention Frito as a segment that was delivering strong pricing. But Pepsi's getting strong pricing in cold beverages as well. And when you look at some of the trends for Coke, Coke's actually getting the best price mix because they are the market leader within carbonated soft drinks, which is the most important category for them. So I think that this is definitely a positive read on Coca-Cola. Even though they don't have a snack segment, we would expect this strong pricing that we've seen for Pepsi to persist with Coke as well as Keurig Dr. Pepper. One thing to note about Coke, the shares have definitely sold off. I know there was, you know, broad market pressure over the course of the month of September, but these shares did sell off more so than some of the other non-alcoholic beverage peers, and that's largely due to currency and some concern around the European consumer. I'll just tell the audience that, you know, Coca-Cola is 66% international.
We have to think about the global component, the currency component when it comes to something like Coca-Cola, which is up more than 1% on the back of that PepsiCo news. Gerald Pascarelli of Wedbush, thank you.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Gotta love on this FOMC Minutes Day. We're watching markets bounce around, getting ready for an inflation print. And you know what we're talking about? Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, you know, a little blast from the past. But we're really pleased this afternoon because we've got Victoria Green. She's Chief Investment Officer at G-Squared Private Wealth. She's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Interviewed you like a dozen times. Never met you in person, Victoria. So welcome back to New York. It's good to have you here. What brings you to the city?
Some of it was just to do a little bit of work and have a couple meetings. And then obviously I hadn't met a lot of my Bloomberg friends in person, so I want to come say hi and meet everybody. So it's been great. By the way, your free snacks, amazing.
We do have good snacks here.
They're really, really good.
You can take some to go home too.
Oh, we have to work now.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, but you're almost done. Give us some clarity. We got Fed minutes today. A reminder: no pivot. They're going to keep raising rates. We did see some bounce off the lows in terms of equities, but we're really little change ahead of the inflation print tomorrow. So how do you look at this market? What's a constructive conversation to have right now?
I think it's too early. I still see some downside risk. I think the print
too early for a pivot?
Too early for a pivot. I actually have been saying the pivot is dead. So everybody that's hopeful for a pivot, it's like wishing for like that sold out toy on Christmas. I really don't think you're going to get it. Like, I'm sorry. I wish I had better news, but I don't think it's coming.
At some point, they're going to pivot. At some point, they're going to stop raising rates, right?
Yeah.
At some point, they will actually cut rates.
At some point, the Dallas Cowboys are probably going to win the Super Bowl again.
Are you saying you never expect the Fed to, like, come on?
Seriously, though, it's a good question. It's also a good question. I think for people who are thinking about buying a home right now, if they say, okay, well, I get locked into a 30-year mortgage 7%, interest rates aren't going to be high forever, so maybe I could refi in 5 years. But is this the new normal?
No, I do think so. If you look at what the Fed funds futures are pricing in, it comes down rather rapidly in 23 and 24.
Right.
So I think, though, nothing this year, you know, they talked about we rather do too much than too little. I think very shortly they're going to have to switch from we need to do too little, not too much, because this delayed reaction of the Fed.
Which is, I feel like the momentum was there. I think that was in the FOMC minutes today, that they're more concerned about doing too little rather than too much.
Yeah, and at some point they're going to be much more concerned about, hey, we did too much, we need to back off. I don't think we're there yet. That's my thesis. We've got a little bit more downside. The Fed's not bailing us out. You know, at some point, and it was a little Machiavellian how we rallied on the UK problems that we had, because everybody said, oh, it's going to get so bad, it's good. We're just not there yet. We have the data points from labor markets still too tight. Pepsi came out with great earnings. Like, there's stress, but there's not
Intel stress. Intel came out and said it's cutting thousands.
They are, and the tech sector is one of those that we say avoid right now. Like, look at the chip market, you know, for months now, oh, it's attractive, but then mm-hmm. you keep getting bad news on PC sales, and, you know, and that sector, like, just because a stock's down 50% doesn't mean it can't go down another 30,
good
and
point.
You've got so many macro headwinds.
Okay, so what's an investor to do in this environment? If you're saying the pivot is dead, it's too early for a pivot at this point, when do we see a bottom here?
It's 34 to 32. I don't think we're that far off,
okay.
but mostly because of multiples. The earnings have remained rather robust. I don't think 240 is kind of the average street for next year. I think that's still a little bit too high. But even if we're flat at 225, mm-hmm. 3,400, that gets you a 15, 16 handle. That's not a bad place to be looking. But stay defensive. The biggest thing an investor can do is don't panic or don't knee-jerk on data. We've seen wild moves off of some of these data releases or Fed moves. And a lot of times it's a 1 or 2 day move and comes back to trend. So I would say, like, one day, 1 week does not a market make. Like, be a little bit patient. And then if you've got equities now, unless you're worried you have a zombie or something that's going to completely blow up, it really just hold on to it. And we talked through a little bit cash and liquidity. Dividends are great right now. You've got Tara versus Tino because you have all.
So you would be moving aggressively into cash at this point?
No. I think you got to, you know when to hold them, know when to fold them. And at this point, you got to hold, unless you have something that's a credit risk or a blow up risk.
What's
a
credit risk right now?
I mean, talk about the Russell 3000 and some of the zombie companies in there, or I would say not to pick on Cathie Wood, but some of the ARK fund, like the innovative stuff, the cool stuff that did so well so long, right now, typically smaller companies, higher leverage, no real earnings, mm-hmm. and they're keeping raising capital. That's not a good place to be during times of stress. You want quality, you want cash flow, you want a balance sheet that can absorb some problems.
Which is why you like Costco. And you several times have come on and you say you like Costco, and I was just looking up, is it like up about 13%
right.
this year? I know. Down 17% this year, but I think it's had a nice little bounce from its recent low, up about 13% or so.
So yeah. The big reason,
Well, I was just going to say the S&P 500 down 25%.
Correct.
So.
Yeah.
So I like them. One, they make about 75% of their revenues from the U.S. And then they are international, but the remaining, like, most majority in Canada, which the Canada
So no strong
US,
dollar problem.
You have a little bit of dollar problems. Two, all of this inventory problem that Nike and Amazon and everybody have benefits a store like Costco because they're happy to buy things cheaply from Nike and resell it at Costco. They're not beholden to any brand
right.
other than the Kirkland brand, which is amazing. But you know, so they have this purchasing power that other companies don't have. So Nike has to sell. Nike has to get their things off. And so you have a company like Costco that can buy some of the inventory pretty cheap and then resell to their members. They have such a loyal member base.
They do.
And then when you're looking to stretch your dollar, buying
higher socioeconomic too, higher, like, in terms of their consumer, I don't know, who's their
consumer? I think it hits around.
I got to tell you, this is not like Texas, Victoria. We don't have room for, like, you know, 200 rolls of toilet paper in our apartments in New York City. So we're not the Costco shoppers.
I figured you guys learned from the pandemic. Like, you would have a toilet paper
she's
closet.
She's got a basement full of toilet paper. So if you ever run out.
No, Tim and I did have a solution for the lack of toilet paper.
That's a different show.
Hey,
let's move on to United Healthcare before this gets too crazy. Why are you so bullish on United Healthcare?
First off, they have some great pricing power. I mean, anybody who's about to re-up their insurance premiums next year, you know, they have this ability to say, we made record profits.
Soon,
But no, they do. They've got pricing power. They're you know, again, they have a lot more in the U.S. I also think technology-wise with some of the acquisitions they've done, they are looking at other parts of the market, getting into the pharmacy and the telehealth. And, you know, that's a little bit like Teladoc used to be the darling, but then you have the big boys getting into it.
Right.
And they're developing their own program.
I love that you still love energy. I mean, it's hard not to if you look at the super mega uber outperformance of energy this year, and it just kind of continues. Cheniere is one name. Just got about 20 seconds. Why that name? Up 66% so far this year. Cheniere.
Oh, Cheniere's great. So LNG exporting, we are going to win what Russia loses. So they're about, they have the biggest ports, well-run company, and they have the ability to expand. So as Russia backs out, Europe's looking for natural gas. They're the best position. They're also a very, very well-run company, and they have the biggest ports and terminals to get it out there.
Great stuff. So fun to have you in town. Come back soon. Safe travels home. She's going to go back to Texas. Victoria Green, Chief Investment Officer, G Squared Private Wealth, here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.